So tonight is Yom HaShoah, and it's an opportunity for us to reflect, and to do that, we're going to take the opportunity to hear a little bit, just a small snapshot of a really extraordinary life, and thank you for making this opportunity possible for us. Maybe tell us just the beginning, a little bit about where your family is from, what your parents were like, where your siblings were up to, what your life was like at the beginning of the 30s as this story gets started.
Okay. I was born in 1924. In 1933, Hitler, Yimach Shemo, got into power, at which time, I'm just making it very fast, at which time I was in a Goyish school. And the first thing they did to us, to Jewish children, we were very few, came from a small town. We were maybe eight students. They put us in the last row.
I think you need to keep it very close.
They put us in the last row and didn't ask any question. And shortly thereafter, they kicked us out altogether. Where I lived, there was no Jewish school available. So I had to go to the nearest town that had a school, and had to take a train in the morning to get there and come back in the afternoon. After a while, this was impossible. So my parents sent, and I have a brother, I had an older brother, and he went to the yeshiva in Frankfurt, and they sent me to what they called, at that time I went to the high school in Frankfurt, Shamshirfeld Hirsch High School, and I stayed in the children's home. I mean, actually students, I mean, went to school. And my parents eventually had to come also because my father lost his job, I mean, his business that he had, and they moved to Frankfurt. Now, we go a little bit further, and in 1938, was Kristallnacht, which was actually the beginning of the Holocaust. Besides my brother being the first one being killed in Germany in 1933, but at that time it was not a program against all the Jews. It was against what they considered any anti-Nazi. And but then in 1938, when a Jewish fellow shot somebody in Paris, they started the pogrom and put the people into the concentration camp. My father was one of them, and my father at that time was in the 60s. And they came in 1938, in November 1938, and arrested my father. I mean, they had the names. I mean, in Germany, everything was organized to the point that they knew exactly where people lived. So they were able to come to the house and arrested my father. Went away. We didn't know what happened. Incidentally, the synagogues were also burned, and we lived right behind the main synagogue in Frankfurt, the Orthodox synagogue. So they already had arranged before they started burning the synagogue, with the fire department be all around it in case the fire would go over the houses. So they burned them down, and the next day they came back, and they had a list of where people live. They were looking for my brother, my older brother. My older brother wasn't home, and I was home, so they came to see me, and they said to me, "Oh, we'll take this one." I was 14 years old, and so my mother came there and said, "How can you take a boy 14? Oh, so I said, "Okay, go away." But later on, my brother did see the mob in the street, so he waited till they were gone. Then he came into the house. So my mother right away said, "The best thing to do for you is to go under a bed in one of the rooms," and we stayed there and hit out. Would you believe that about 2 hours later they came back again? They were looking for my brother. My brother was 18 already at that time. So my mother stood in front of the room. They went through the whole house, couldn't find anything. But in the bedroom that we were in, we were under the bed, they wanted to go in there. So my mother stood in front of there's nobody there. And whoever was the leader, somewhere rather, the bunch of them gave him the things. He says, "Oh, she says nobody there. Go away." So they left us alone, and we went under in the attic after that, till everything more or less blew over a little bit. My father was in the concentration camp in Buchenwald, I would say, about 4 weeks, 6 weeks. Don't forget, this was November. And he left without any decent clothes, just the way that he was in the house. He came back on a Shabbos, I'll never forget. I mean, he rang the bell, and nobody rings a bell on Shabbos by us. So I looked out of the window. I see an old man there. So I said, so my sister, who had, her husband had then also been taken into Dachau, comes over and looks over and says, that's her father. I said, I couldn't believe it. So I went downstairs, opened the door for her. And the only reason he got out of the concentration camp, because he was in the First World War, and he had the Iron Cross. They gave him the Iron Cross. So your Machshimo Hitler, who had the Iron Cross, he let him out of the concentration camp.
Can you tell us a little bit about your older brother from 1933?
I had two older siblings. I mean, our family actually consisted of two separate things. My parents got married in 1911, in January. My oldest brother was born in December 1911. And my sister was born in 1913. So there were two siblings, and my father had to go to the war in 1914. And didn't come out in 1918. So there were no children in between, and then the next set of children was my brother, 1921, and I was 24. My oldest brother went against my parents' wishes, actually, and became a doctor. My father didn't want him to be a doctor because of a coin. He says, yeah, what is it for you to become a doctor? But he insisted he wanted to be a doctor. He's very, very intelligent, very intelligent. He became a doctor at a very young age, which was usually unheard of in Germany. Then he decided, they were talking about cancer at that time. That was 1933. In Germany, did not have anything particularly in cancer. He found out that there was a cancer course in Paris at the Sorbonne. So he wrote to the Sorbonne, and they accepted him right away. While he was at the Sorbonne, he found out there was an advanced course in cancer in Edinburgh, and the University of Edinburgh. So he wrote a letter there. They accepted him there. So he flew from Paris to Edinburgh. In the meantime, since my brother got killed in 1933, my mother decided, they all wanted to get education outside of the country. So my older sister, became an au pair in England. And she went to England as an au pair, which means she took care of children. She learned English and everything else. My brother, who was in Edinburgh, decided to go back to Germany. He hadn't a passport. Decided to go back to Germany to pick up his own paper, which was missing, which was a minor paper. Hitler had already been in power, but nobody knew. It was 8 weeks after Hitler got in power. He flew to the university. Somebody recognized him as being an anti-Nazi or whatever he is, whatever he did. He wasn't an anti-Nazi. But he was against the Nazis, put it this way. And they recognized him and they muscled him. But he had already left. He was on his way back to Edinburgh. But he stopped off in Nuremberg. I had two uncles in Nuremberg. So the Gestapo already, don't forget, this was 4 weeks, 8 weeks after Hitler got in power, came to my father and wanted to know where his son is. My father smelled the rat right away. He said, what do you want to do with my son? We want to just ask him a few questions. My father realized we knew where my brother was, and my father was afraid to tell him where he was. So I had two uncles in Nuremberg. One was my father's brother, one was my mother's brother. We knew he was by my mother's brother. He knew it wasn't by his brother. So he told him he was by his brother. So they went to his brother. The Nazis went to his brother. This is not by me, it's by the other uncle. So they arrested him, took him to Dachau, which is already at that time, they just took a field and surrounded it with fences and everything else. And he was one of the first. There were four Jews there. There were a couple of others, Goyim also. And the next day, they took him out and shot him. So he was the first Jew. Actually, there were three Jews that were killed. He was one of the first. And there is a Goy that wrote a book about Hitler's first victims. And he tells my brother being the first, he put him on the back.
How old was your brother?
My brother was in his 20s.
Mid-20s.
Let's see, he was born in 1911.
Right, yes, 27. So maybe tell a little bit about how you ended up coming to America.
Okay, well, I just wanted to tell one thing about something else. Now, the Nazis didn't want to know anybody what happened. And my father wanted to get the mess out. I mean, they called him up and says, your son was shot, whatever the case may be. Happened to be Pesach, first days of Pesach. He was killed on the second day of Pesach, 1933. So my father insisted on getting it. So the Nazi party said, if you want to get your son out, pay 100,000 marks to get him out, and under the condition that you do not open up the coffin at all. Just, if you want to take him, bury him the way he is. Was a nice rabbi, very big rabbi in Nuremberg, Rabbi Klein. So my father called him up. He says, how can you bury somebody? You don't know what's it. Don't bring him to Gvura. So he said, it happens to be Cholam Moed anyhow. You can't beg a hesped, you can't do anything else. And in case they watch you, I says, just bury him. Wait 2 weeks and dig him up. And then you bring him to Gvura. And Kachoya, when they opened it up, found out shot right through the head. Okay, that was it. And it was then buried in Nuremberg in the Jewish cemetery.
So then tell us how you ended up in America after Kristallnacht.
We went after Kristallnacht in 1938. We had to go out. My mother, Odea Sholom, had family in America. Not from. So it's just as it is today. I mean, you need a quota system to come to America. So in those years, if you wanted to come to America, you had to go to the American consulate and ask for a number. The number came up, and they were able to get to America. So our number was pretty far away, and we knew after Kristallnacht something was going to happen. So my brother, who was in the yeshiva in Frankfurt, they opened up the yeshiva gates and didn't have any bochum. So they asked Frankfurt the yeshiva to send people from Frankfurt to Gateshead. So he was able to get out in January. My father and I, Sigurd Vrohr, got out 3 days before the war started. And we flew from Frankfurt to London. My mother, Hashem, got out a day before the war started. She flew to London. We stayed in London for a year till the number came up. We came to America on Erev Pesach, 1940.
And then how did you end up in the service? Drafted or had
you know, that's another story.
Good. That's why we're here.
No, everybody was drafted. I mean, like today. I mean, everybody's being drafted once you're 18 years old. If you refused, they put you in a quarantine, whatever. I mean, they put you in a thing. But if I don't think there was any German Jew that really refused. I mean, every German Jew that was there would go in the army. Except, I was only 16 when I came. Okay? I had to go to work. And I went to the first job, and they asked me how old I was. I was 16. The guy said, we can hire you. I says, why not? He says, you have to go to school 1 day a week. Okay? I says, and I can't hire you and I give you a job 1 day a week and go to school. And then what am I going to do? Okay. Go to the next store, next place. It happened to be across Williamsburg in what they call Long Island City. I go to the next place. How old are you? 18. Okay. They hired me. Had a problem with Shabbos. Because of Mr. Goyshev company, and had just gotten war work from the army at that time. I mean, the government gave out two. I was number 7 in the company, and in a short time, they had 30, 40, 50 people. The government paid for everything. So Shabbos comes along. The guy says to me, you're number 7 in the company. He says, this Saturday, you get time and a half. Incidentally, I made 12 cents an hour.
12 cents an hour.
Okay, anyway, so he said...
1940.
So he said to me, you get time and a half. I said, I don't want time and a half. I said, fine. He left me alone. Same Shabbos. I didn't know what to do. I mean, Shabbos, the first Shabbos was all right. Second Shabbos was all right. All of a sudden, I mean, they got so much work that they needed the people. So he came to me again. He went, time and a half. We're going to... I said, no, nothing doing. Anyway, came Shavuos. Happened to be in the middle of the week, Thursday and Friday or something. Comes over to me on Wednesday. He says, right now we don't need you so much. I mean, I will call you again. Go home. I said to my parents, "Nes min shemayim." I didn't have to tell them that I wouldn't come in anyway. I came home. On Monday, I came back. Says to me, "Who called you back?" I said, "You said only a few days." Said, "Okay, they already." So we were going there. In the meantime, my bosses wanted to know how come I wasn't called in the army. According to them, I was 18. So I mentioned to them, they must have overlooked me. I don't care. I registered. When I finally got my call up, the thing, and I came to him, I got the call up, says, "No, now we need you. Now we need you. And he got me 2 or 3 deferments not to go to the army. When they finally called me up, the last time they got me a deferment, my brother was called up at the same time. They wouldn't take 2 brothers at the same time, so I got another deferment. Then finally, I had to go into the army. There's nothing else. The interesting thing was, again, Hakol Min HaShemayim. I'll tell you that much.
So I'll translate that. For those who don't speak Hebrew, Hakol Min HaShemayim means everything is from God. Everything is from the heaven. So God is kind of orchestrating the story.
Yeah.
He was with you the whole time?
Exactly. What?
He was with you the whole time.
All the time.
Okay.
All the time. I got into the army, and he had a certain IQ. You could go to either officer's candidate school or whatever it happened to be. I happened to be the machinist, so somebody gave me an etzer. It says, you can go to machinist school, and machinist school, after 3 months, you go to advanced machinist school. And then you tell them you want to go to officer's candidate school. I had enough points. You stay out of the war for a year. It made a lot of sense.
So I have to keep the microphone. Yeah, you want me to hold it?
No, I made a lot of sense. So I decided, when they asked me, I want to go to officer's candidate school, I want to go machinist school. It so happened, machinist school was a terrific deal. It was outside Baltimore. It was a camp called Halliburton, outside Baltimore, run by civilians, which means it closed at 5 o'clock, opened up at 9 o'clock in the morning. The only soldiers were there. And not only this, on Friday it closed at 5 o'clock. And on Monday morning it opened up at 9 o'clock. I was able to go home to New York every weekend. Take the train to New York, come home for Shabbos, and come back on Monday morning. It was for 3 months, it was terrific. After 3 months were up, I said, I want to go to advanced school. Nothing to do, you're going overseas. So I fooled myself. I got overseas. But I was in the combat engineers. They sent me to... No, they couldn't send me. I wasn't a citizen, right? So they put me in a jeep, sent me to Columbus, Ohio, in front of a church. They said to me, want to be a citizen? I said, yes. I swear, okay, you're a citizen.
That was it.
That was it. No questions.
Was anybody concerned that you were back with the company?
The company went back to New York to be shipped overseas. They suddenly realized they don't have my citizenship papers. They couldn't find my citizenship papers. They can't send me overseas without a citizenship paper. So, okay. So take me out of my company. Out of my company that was in. And made me what they call a replacement. A replacement. Now as a replacement, I went with my own company to England in the Queen Elizabeth in 2 days. But I wasn't with a company. They put me what they call a replacement camp. Okay. I waited in replacement camp to be reassigned. I wasn't reassigned for I don't know how long, maybe a month. Unusual. They finally reassigned me to an all Southern outfit. I was a damn Yankee from early morning till night. I had no idea what I'm talking about. I didn't know about the Civil War. They were still fighting the Civil War. So damn Yankee from morning. Damn, when they found I was a Jew, then it was the damn Yankee Jew. The only way I got any derech eretz from them, I took the biggest shlop that they had, and I said, I want to show you what a damn Yankee Jew can do to a damn rebel. So everybody was afraid of the guy. So they made, and this was winter time in England, high snow. Snow. They had big boots on. So they made a circle. So he wanted to box me. I had no idea about boxing. The guy hits me on the nose and the blood comes out. But it was a wrestler, a good wrestler. I says, you're a damn rebel here. Boxing, every little kid knows how to box. If you want to know how strong you are, you wrestle. He said, okay, you wrestle. I had him on the floor in 2 minutes. And I put my foot on his gargle and I said, now tell me, who is a damn Yankee Jew? No, you're a rebel. That's the only way he got respect. But there was still plenty anti-Semitism in the American army. And plenty, plenty, plenty. Just one example. Pesach came. I had an uncle in London. I went to, and the Aguda was in London. Wanted to know what he can do for Pesach. I said, do me a favor, send me some matzah and some wine, whatever case may be, so at least I can have a seder at night. The company commander that I had, also an anti-Semit, every time he put me on guard duty, was always Shabbos. So I went over to him and told him, tonight is a very important day for me, the night for me. Don't put me on guard duty, I go twice instead of that. He put me on guard duty that night. So I had the package from the Aguda. I put it in my duffel bag. I put a lock on it. Went on guard duty. Came back at 12 o'clock. They sliced my duffel bag. Ate everything that I had. Drank the wine. Ate the matzahs. Ate the cake. Ate the salami. Everything else. I mean, when you talk about anti-Semitism in the American army in those days, I mean, it's, people don't realize that. But anyway.
So then maybe let's fast forward a little bit to going to D-Day. What was that experience like?
Then they had the luck to being in the first American troops that landed in D-Day. And the reason was I was in the combat engineers, and we were building in England. We were building obstacles for them. So we knew that the Germans, I mean, we had movies of the Germans building obstacles. So we went, I mean, our company was broken up in small units, and we were the first ones. The problem I had, number one, I wouldn't take my children, my sitter with me. Number two, they're supposed to give you a dog tag when you come to the army. I mean, name, rank, and serial number, that's all they had. And they put an H on there for Hebrew. My luck was that in New York, when they took me in, my name was Lothar Kahn. My father's name, Levi Kahn. The whole address, 281 Wadsworth Avenue, New York. And Hebrew written on. Here I'm going to an invasion of Normandy, and I have their dog tag on me. And I said, they should catch me. I mean, it's dead dog. So I took, in all desperation, I cut off my father's name, which made it more obvious, naturally. Okay. But Baruch Hashem, I made it. My film, my sitter...
Well, one second. How did you get there? You went by boat or by plane?
To where?
Into France.
No, by boat. They had big boats, which we left, we left England. Then we went to the small boats. They had smaller boats, what they called LCVP, landing craft personnel.
So what date did you go?
What?
What date did you land?
On D-Day, A-Day. And not only D-Day, H-Hour. I was with the first American troops. Our job was supposed to blow the obstacles so the other ships could come in. The Germans built obstacles, what they call a gate. You figure out a gate, figure metal pieces that run up, and on the metal pieces they put mines, which means a ship would come in, run up on these things, come down, get a hole in the side, couldn't go out anymore. It was a dead duck. But at the same time, you couldn't do anything anyhow, because the first day, 100,000 Americans got killed. So you can imagine, they came in wave after wave after. I came in with 100 pounds of explosives on me. I mean, to blow the obstacles. I couldn't do it at all. Again, talking about the Rebbeinu Shlom. When we came in, nobody came out alive. I mean, where we were supposed to come in. Had a terrible storm. We were pushed off. Near a cliff. I was able to go out. Now, the thing is this. The Germans were sitting there with machine guns, going this way and this way and this way. They couldn't pick you out, but you had to pass it. So I was able to see the bullets in the sand before the water came in. So I had to go behind it, and then when they came from the other side, I went ahead of it. Then the water came in, right? Then I could see the bullets in the water. So Baruch Hashem, the boy gave me the sechel that I was able to get to the beach.
Did anyone in your unit get killed in that first?
What?
Anyone in your unit was killed in that?
Oh, a lot. I mean, not only our unit killed, a lot of others' units got killed. And I was finally safe against the cliff. So Nebuch, they didn't have any soldiers. I mean, 100,000 people, they used to go up and down the beach. He says, come on, any soldier, come on. I wasn't going to go with them. Our job really was, for about 2 weeks afterwards, to clean up the beach, to remove the obstacles so they could come in properly. But I mean, it was just Nissen giving an example. Unfortunately, I shouldn't tell that either. Only the ration we had, and only we had to eat, we could eat, what they gave us was a chocolate bar. I guess it was with vitamins, well, I guess maybe. So I have to eat a chocolate bar. What do you eat next? So we cut off the chocolate bars from the dead soldiers. They all had chocolate bars on them. At nighttime, when the water came in, we took the rifles of the with the bayonets and stuck them in the sand and put the bodies in between and thought we would be safe from the water. And after the water came in all the way to us and washed them out. I mean, this was the first, second day. Let's move on. The next thing that we did, I always wanted to look. I'm going to make it short. I wanted to look for Jews, but any Jews were left. We went from France to Belgium to Luxembourg and everything else. So wherever I went, I mean, I couldn't find any Jews. But what I would do, at nighttime, I would go to the bar, the Schenk, where all the Goyim naturally celebrated, they were liberated, and look around and ask somebody. I mean, I could speak French, because I was lucky. I learned French in school in Frankfurt. They changed the language every 3 years. My time was in French. English I learned in England. But anyway, so I went around and asked. So no Jews here. No Jews in this time. Okay. In Belgium, I remember, I don't remember exactly, I think it was Liège. I go into the bar at nighttime, and I sit next to a guy, and I speak to him in French. He answers me in perfect English. I said, how come you speak English? He says, I'm from Brooklyn. he was a flyer. It wasn't an air. He was shut down, and the Marquise, the underground, saved him. Saved him. I mean, they kept him hidden, everything else. I said to him, how long have you been here in this town? He says, 5 months, 6 months. Are there any Jews in this town? He says, yes, a Jew, one Jew here. Who's a Jew? Jew is a baker. I says, the Goyim needed a baker. So but they wouldn't let him be a Jew. So he had to put all kind of Madonnas and crucifixes and you name it in the bakery. I said, I want to see that again. So I went over, he took me over to the guy, and sure enough, he had everything. He said to me, it saved my life. I mean, the Goyim wouldn't muzzle him, because if they needed him as a baker, and the Germans, I mean, didn't see it. They seen all the crucifixes and the mice. That was the only Jew in the whole war, I mean, until the war was over, they seen.
And then when the war was over, where were you stationed?
When the war was over, again, Eisenhower helped the Russians. The Germans were fighting the Russians to surrender to the Americans. We were in, at that time, we were at the border of Czechoslovakia and Germany. And Eisenhower said, we will help the Russians and we will move into Czechoslovakia and hold it for them. So we were sent into Czechoslovakia. And when the war ended, I was in headquarters in Czechoslovakia. And in the morning, I see the letter, two letters actually. One letter said the company was so terrific, it's being sent to America for redeployment to Japan. And the next letter said, since the war ended suddenly, that anybody who could speak German could volunteer to be in military government in Germany. I had lots of family left, I mean, in Germany, when we went. We didn't know what happened. So I volunteered right away. I mean, I want to be German. So they put me in a jeep, and they sent me to Bamberg, Germany. No Jew left, nothing at all. My mother, Leah Sholem, there was a newspaper in New York, maybe it still exists, Aufbau for German Jews, in which every week they recorded people who came back from the concentration camp. Amongst the things that they had was a name, Bertha Oppenheimer, who was the sister of my mother. So my mother naturally says that I can do anything. She sends me a letter. I says, my sister just came back to Würzburg and take a jeep and pick her up and take her to Bamberg. Okay. So I took a jeep and I went to Bamberg. It was in an old age home at that time. And I asked for the Bertha Oppenheimer. The Bertha Oppenheimer, I says, left last night for Cologne. Now, we had no mishpoch in Cologne, so I knew it was my aunt. So I was going back to my car, an American soldier. A woman shepherds up to me and she wants to know what the American soldier did here. I couldn't get rid of it. I finally told her the story. So she said to me, that woman last night wasn't your aunt at all. But last night your cousin came from Riga, from the concentration camp in Riga, and she's sleeping upstairs. I says, my cousin? Sure, my cousin. I says, wake her up. I can't do anything for her here, but I can take her to Bamberg, where I'm a Kanzermacher dort. In Bamberg were three Jews that ran the whole thing. It's very interesting. I was in military government. Another Jew who happened to be a friend of mine, Orthodox Jew from Williamsburg, he was attached to the United Nations. And a third Jew, not a friend, was attached, what they called the CIC, Counterintelligence Corps. Between the three Yidlach, nothing moved in that we didn't know. That we didn't know. I wanted two things. I needed the prison, because anybody was arrested by the Americans, which was 99% curfew. Any German was caught out after curfew was arrested. And the other one was, I wanted to have the banks, the safe deposit box, because every Nazi, high Nazi, had any important papers in the safe deposit box. If they didn't take it out before, they had to take it out when I was there. And when I was there and they had a Nazi, I called him the guy from the CIC. I says, arrest the guy, he's a Nazi. That's the way it went. Finally, one day, I get a list from the guy. There are six Yidden on the list. I says, in Bamberg were no Yidden. How did he get the Yidden in Bamberg? I said, I have to take him out, because the American judge that they had would put him in jail altogether. And see a Yidden there in Bamberg? So I said to my friend from the United Nations, I said, Shmuel, his name is Shmuel Taube, Shmuel, they're Yidden in thing, we have to take him out, but I have no way of putting him up. I mean, I can't put him up in military government. I said, don't worry, United Nations, we got cuts, we got bad, everything else. So we went together, and I said to the guy there, who knew me already, and I picked out a name, Shmuel, whatever it is. I says, give me a room, and let me interrogate that man. Okay, he gives me a room. The Yid Nebuch comes in, he comes from Buchenwald. They just released him from Buchenwald. And here he's being back in prison in Bamberg. I said, what happened? I says, Avtzalochus, the train that was supposed to take him to Munich, to a camp in Munich, I says, had a problem with the engine. So they had to fix the engine. So unser Yidlach don't stay on the train. You know what I mean? They have to go out, they have to march around, and they have to go to town also, look around for the town. So six of them were arrested.
Could you tell us a little bit about the trains? Did you see trains or graffiti or anything?
I have the picture. It's just what I'm coming to right now.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the thing was that I took the six out, and I told you the guy came in and said, Shalom Aleichem, Ayid. Oh, Ayid. Anyway, I took him. I couldn't take him. He took him for the thing. He says, tomorrow morning you come to the military government, I'll give you a pass. One other interesting thing before we get to that, my cousin, whom I took out, who came back from Riga. I took him back and I couldn't take her in. She had no identification, but mazel for me, she was still in the prison guard. So I went over, and every city had a guard in front before you get into the city. So I come there, and I told him I'm military government. I arrested the woman, and he couldn't say no. Says the woman was in prison, and I have to interrogate her here, but I have no identification. What do? I leave her with you here. I says, I go in the military government, I bring you a release for her. I went to the military, and I told her, you have to stay with them. They're like, go in, get your way out of the pass, come back. I got her in. That's the way you got her in. These Yidlach, same story, had no identification. So they had to come to the military government or to get them out. So,
what did these look like, these Jews from Buchenwald?
No, I have the picture. They're normal. I mean, this was already, don't forget, 6 weeks after the day. But what happened is they came in and had the Germans wait in line, you know, to come in there. And here the Yidlach come, go right in front of the line. You know.
So the Jews finally went to the front.
So the Germans schreit, Chaybekai, whatever it gets me. I come outside, I hear a schrei, I said, come right with me, give them the pass. I didn't realize the train was still in Bamberg, okay? They went back to the train and said, why do you have to go to Munich? Jews here in Bamberg to take care of you. The next thing I know, I had 20 people. I mean, I didn't know what to do with them either. But that's this whole story. I found the Jewish apartment, the Jews that got killed. I went to the military governor, and I told him I need these apartments. He wrote out an order to evacuate them. And I went to the mayor and says, here's the order, the X amount of whatever rooms we needed. I says, get rid of the Germans. We put the Jews in there. Okay. Amongst the apartment that he signed to eliminate was a place where he slept with the Sixers. The governor. I'm going to make it very short. So in order, she came to him. And not only this. This woman...
Meaning the mistress was upset that he evacuated their apartment.
Naturally. But okay. No. But the mistress, okay. Mistress spoke a perfect English and worked for him in military government.
She was German?
She was a German. Spoke a perfect English, worked for him in English. So I called my friend from the CIC and said, do me a favor, check her out. I mean, I can't believe that she learned English in a German thing. It must have been something. He came back. And he found out not only was she a Nazi official, she was a high Nazi official in the women's Nazi party. And according to Eisenhower, she had been in jail. Yeah. So I gave him the thing. He says, you know, put it in the thing. 4 weeks later, I went to the guy, sent me another report. Sent me another one. He says, you know what? The woman is still working for the middle of the government. According to Eisenhower, she should be in jail. Fine. When this miser happened, however, then and then he realized what he did, that he signed the name. So shortly thereafter, I would say about a month later, a guy comes in from the adjutant general. He says, you Mr. Khan? Yes. I have an order for a court-martial. I say, have an order for a court-martial? Yeah. Insubordination and misuse of authority. That's what he had.
For you?
For me. I says... Why it was misused? I made my own thing, and I didn't tell him exactly what was it. So I said, "Well, I'll tell you one thing. If you want to court-martial me," I says, "the American papers will be terrific. They will know that here's a military governor who went against Eisenhower and hired a Shiksa that, according to him, was supposed to be in jail." Ah, oh, this we can't do.
So this mistress with the military governor saved your military career.
No, they didn't say my military. I would have been. I mean, I only signed up for 6 months.
Ah, okay.
I would have gone away. But anyway.
Nonetheless, you're still grateful for this.
But anyway, coming back. Now, what do I do with all the Yiddish? I didn't know what to do. I got him in an apartment.
We have to get to the graffiti also soon.
But we had to also put him up, and I have to get them a place where they can. Now they had an identification, so I went to the mayor and said to him, "Where was the last synagogue?" The last synagogue, that's the machine shop. I went back to the office, wrote an order, moved the machine shop in 24 hours. I can't. 24 hours, we can't move machinery. I give you 48 hours. There's a difference. Okay.
Was anybody supervising when you were writing these orders?
I told you, I was the only one of the American Army that spoke German. I was a Macher in the military government.
Okay.
No, and he was a Macher in the United Nations.
Well, what rank were you at this time?
Nothing. No, I shouldn't say that. I was a corporal.
Okay.
But I was a tech corporal, actually, for the thing. But anyway, so what happened was, like I said, the train was still there and had on it.
Let me hold this.
It was a cattle train. I mean, it wasn't a fancy train. Yeah.
What is. Oh. This is the train?
Yeah.
So, can we pass the picture around?
We'll show you.
If anybody wants to come up afterwards, you'll see the side of this train. You see there's graffiti on the side. There's a Jewish star, and it says, Tov Lomos Ba'ar Arzenu, Am Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. It is good to die for our Jewish people. The Jewish people are alive and established. This is the graffiti. If you can see from the back, you can come up afterwards and take a look. This is the photograph.
If you think it wasn't a short train.
So this, who's this standing in front of the train?
What?
Who's this in front of the train?
This is the one from the United Nations.
The United Nations. So you can see.
The Orthodox.
Anybody wants to come up afterwards, take a look at this photograph.
Me.
This is you. Where?
Only one guy here.
No shirt.
No.
No, where? He, oh, this American, the officer. Yes. Who are these guys with the notion?
No idea. They were from the train.
They're from the train. So these are guys who are coming from Buchenwald. All along this train. So if anybody wants to come up afterwards, take a look at the pictures.
Okay. What I wanted to tell you also.
I want to open up for a couple of questions before we finish. Yeah.
This was a group after a while.
I'll hold the picture now. Go ahead.
This was a synagogue that they had a made for them.
This was in the machine shop? Was it converted?
Yeah. And this was the group that eventually wound up in Bamberg. I mean, you think there were a few. There are quite a few.
Yeah, there looks like hundreds of people here. A few dozen people at least. It's a full
fact,
room.
As a matter of fact,
this is the photograph of the shul, the synagogue in Bamberg, the first minyan in this renovated synagogue in May of 1945. You could see there's a makeshift bima, like a table with a talis on the front of it, and you see Jews in jackets and caps and an aron kodesh, like a makeshift standalone aron kodesh in the front. This is the photograph with the empty without pews, people. And then this is the photograph with the people in the chairs. Who took these pictures? Someone asked.
I don't know. Somebody. Not me.
He doesn't know.
I didn't take it. I just want to show some. This was a synagogue in Frankfurt that the Germans destroyed and made a bunker out of it. A bunker. Put Red Cross all over it.
So that nobody would bomb it?
Right.
Yeah. So you'll see if anybody wants to come up afterwards. It looks like a fortified bunker. And this was the original. The synagogue of the Reb Shamshon Rafael Hirsch, and there's that the Red Cross on the side of it. This was in Frankfurt.
I want to mention one more thing.
And then we'll open to questions. Open some questions.
Yeah, we can do it.
Okay.
Nissimony Flores.
Miracles. Let's get one miracle story.
Yeah. When I left my company, my machine shop in New York, and the company was taken over by some Israelis, not from at all. He said to me, I don't know how frum you are, but I tell you what, I give you two things. One was a little metal tablet,
which means, if I forget you, Jerusalem, my right arm should be forgotten. So this was the gift they gave you?
Yeah, and the second one was a little mezuzah, not a kosher mezuzah, a little mezuzah.
Okay. I see it's attached to the dog tag.
Which I attached to the dog tag. Anyway. During the German breakthrough, I was sent out on a patrol in order to check up on outposts. And we had to go through, the Germans broke through. I was actually in the First Army, but during the breakthrough, what they call the Battle of the Bulge, I was attached to the Third Army, which was Patton, Michigan, all the way through. He made conditions, that are very hard to keep. You had to have your helmet all the time. You couldn't do this, you couldn't do this, you couldn't do that. I mean, it's, and not only this, he changed passwords every 2 minutes. I mean, anyway, we went on patrol, and the lieutenant and I went out there to check on the outpost. On the way back, the Germans were all around us, started shooting at us. I lost control of the jeep. The jeep turned over. It was heavy, heavy snow. Nobody got hurt, but the jeep turned over. And here we are, under the jeep, in no man's land, with Germans around us, and we didn't know what to do. We couldn't do anything. We just stayed there. Baruch Hashem, a truck came, an American truck came. And so we asked him, would do me a favor and take the lieutenant, actually, it was first, would go in with the truck, and he told me, I come in and I tell him that you are stranded out here, and you couldn't abandon any equipment either. So I had to stay with the equipment. And I'll send out a thing to pick you up. Okay. Naturally, he went in, forgot about me altogether. I'm standing there, cold. Think now the problem was someone else. His helmet was under my jeep, and the American Army had a division of non-commissioned officer and commissioned officer. One had a stripe down the back, a vertical, and one had a horizontal. So I had the horizontal, and he had a vertical. So he said to me, listen, they don't know who I am. I says, give me your helmet, because I can't go in, otherwise they'll be right away. I says, and You take your helmet, I'll send them out and I'll tell them who you are. Forget all about it. Okay. Finally, frozen like anything, another truck comes by. I tell them the story, and they believe me, and they took my Jeep out of the thing. Now it was going crooked. In addition to that, I mean, I had no helmet. I wouldn't wear his helmet. I wouldn't wear no lieutenant's helmet. So I had a motorcycle cab, which was also illegal, according to me. Okay. We go into the place, I mean, into our, wherever was that. All of a sudden, it's a dividing line in a road. And he says, we are going this way, and you go this way. I don't know the difference. The Jeep was, there was no traffic anyway. The Jeep was going crooked. I get to the first outpost. The guy said, what's your password? What's the password? I give him the old password hours ago. That's not the password. Where's your helmet? helmet is the lieutenant's helmet. And I tell him the story. I went, they changed guards. We don't know anything about the thing. Make a long story short. Two guys, one happened to be a Yidl, Baruch Hashem. Other was a goy. They were scared themselves. So they said to me, put him against the wall, shoot him. I said, there's a German spy. I mean, they were right. The Jeep was crooked. I didn't have a helmet. I didn't know the password. Everything. Anyway, it was going back and forth and back and forth. Where's your dog tag? Now, my dog tag, it was so cold, I put it in my little pocket in here, and that frozen, stiff frost, man. I says, my dog tag is in my pocket. I says, get it out. He says, I can't get it out. My fingers are frozen. If you want to get it out, I wouldn't come closely. Make a long story short, we waited long enough. I was able to get it out. He said to me, What's this? I says, and I didn't know it was a Yid or a Goy. He says, the Jewish luck charm. I says, is there another word for it? I says, yeah, mezuzah. You're Jewish? I says, do you think I would carry it? He said, we're Jewish. Now he started the Chakir and Drishin. I says, you're from New York? Yeah. What are the subway stations from New York? Okay, don't do that. Now, what five books of Moses came right into my thing? Yeah. And he started questioning me everything. I told him, want to have it in English, want to have it in Hebrew. And finally, he turned to the other guy and says, this guy's not a German. There are no Germans in the German army. No Jews in the German army. That little mezuzah saved my life that the guy gave me.
And that you took with
him. I mean, that thing's happening. Okay, now.
All right. We could obviously go on. We have a couple minutes. We are blessed to have a wonderful group. Anybody have a specific question for Mr. Khan? Anybody want to raise their hand? More than welcome. Yeah, Joel, here, let me give you the microphone.
I'm just curious. You landed in the first wave at Normandy in D-Day. What were your emotions? Were you seeing all these soldiers being killed around you? I mean,
I had no idea. I thought they were sleeping. I mean, they were lying this way. I have a picture, incidentally, lying this way. And as I crawled up, I mean, I crawled through them. I mean, and I got up there, and I said to the fellows, I said, they must be tired. The guy said to me, tired? I said, they're dead. Huh? I had never seen a dead person in my life.
Where did you land exactly on D-Day? Because there's four towns.
We actually... Are you familiar with the beach?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. We were in Normandy, in the Normandy section, in Vierville-sur-Mer.
Okay.
You know where that is?
Yeah, that's where
it was. An open, right, exposed area.
Right.
But we were pushed off a little bit closer to the Canadians.
Okay.
And the food, I mean, as far as food was concerned, they just dropped it in the water. I mean, there was waterproof cases. They dropped in the water, and the tide brought it in.
And so you were blown off course then?
Sure we were, of course. That saved my life. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been dead.
Yes.
How many calves, the three of you who survived the war, how many descendants now, but from the three siblings who survived, how many are you?
I just had my 95th birthday, we were 91 people. Maybe
For the maybe for the young people in the audience, one last thing. What's a message that you would want to share with all of us, and especially with the next generation? What's a key message that you think we should take away from this incredible story?
I think, for a religious Jew, naturally, I mean, you believe that the Baruch Hashem will help you. There's no question about that. I mean, whether you see Nisim and Nivlaos, I mean, that's up to the Baruch Hashem in doing or not. But you have to believe, I mean, there's no question about it. You have to believe that the Baruch Hashem is everywhere. Yeah, I mean, you don't see anything, but you see the action that happened to the individual, I would say. I mean, like, I know definitely I could see the Baruch Hashem all over. Every place I went, I mean, my mistake, the Baruch Hashem was with me.
So for those who are not following the Yiddish, Ribono Shel Olam is a Yiddish euphemism for God. And the idea of seeing God wherever we go, that's an important...
That's right.
That's a beautiful takeaway.
I would give one other thing. It's not self-praise, but since my parents went through a terrible situation, the son losing the daughter.
What happened to your sister?
My sister, when my brother got killed, my mother and sister, my sister was coming back from England.
Right.
She got married, and her husband was arrested and went to Dachau, and he would only be left out if he would leave the country. Now, my sister, for whatever reason, never applied for a number to come to America, but where she was an au pair in England, they helped her husband to get out to England, and the English wouldn't let her in unless she continued on. So she stayed back, and she got killed in 1940.
So it was just you and your brother who survived.
Just me and
my brother. Right. Sorry. Yeah. So in memory, you were thinking about your parents.
What?
Yeah. You were thinking about your parents.
My parents, I mean, after they lost the children, I mean, the two of us that were left, we were very close to our parents. And I believe, as I say, kibbutz of aim is one of the important things.
Which is honoring your mother and your father, taking care of your parents.
Knowing what my parents went through, and me knowing that there was going to be an invasion, and they may lose another son, I decided that I write five letters. Give it to somebody in England and tell them to send a letter every other day to my parents. So when my parents read about the invasion of Normandy, she got a letter from me from England, said, my son is not in the invasion of Normandy. A couple of days later, he got another letter from me from England. And this way, he never knew. If he would have known, you know, the heartbreak, he would have heard that I would be there. So that I feel is very, very important, that the children should honor their parents and come out of them. That's actually...
It's beautiful. The idea of honoring your parents, and in that merit, a person will live a long life. Well, we are blessed to just have this opportunity to be listeners to the incredible, just unbelievable, remarkable life that the Ribono Shel Olam has blessed you with. And we hope that everybody here will walk away with the same feeling and inspiration to carry in their lives that this legacy and this story, one of so many just remarkable heroes who we are privileged to have living in our own community, to be with us this evening. We thank you so, so much for sharing this night with us.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you all for coming.